Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what
and those three little words are, hi, Patricia T. O'Connor. Pat O'Connor joins us once a month to talk about the language and take your calls and comments. Our number 433. What should I say? I guess it's start off with 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And Pat is the author of quite a few books. I'll give you the list later because I'm tired of having to say them all. Pat, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
And it's the holiday season, so
yes,
you've been thinking
is.
About the word holiday. It's a holy day, doesn't it?
Yes, and you've probably heard something about this flap in Rhode Island when Governor Lincoln Chafee dedicated what he called a holiday tree instead of a Christmas tree in the State House. He got a lot of flack. Got a lot of conservative Christians exercised. They don't like to see the word holiday used in place of Christmas. Chafee defended himself on grounds that using holiday instead of Christmas was more inclusive and more recognized the religious diversity of the state. And
well, how is a tree? I've always wondered this. How is a tree a religious symbol? I thought it was had more to do with the winter solstice.
And, yes, it does.
And traditions, actually pagan traditians that
sure.
predate Christianity.
Oh, sure. Many, many of the words and behaviors and rituals we associate with Christmas actually predate Christianity, including the winter solstice decorating of trees, the burning of Yule logs,
what does Yule come from, other than Yule Brynner?
Yule is it probably comes from an old Scandinavian, a Norse word, Yule, which had to do with the winter solstice. And a similar word was used as the name of December or January. And one name of the Norse god Odin was Jolnir, Yule figure.
Hmm. But it has nothing to do with the South, where glad to see Yule?
That's Yal, different vowel. But Yule, for actually 1,000 years after the birth of Christ, Yule was the name of Christmas. It wasn't called Christmas until the 12th century. But at any rate, to get back to holiday, recently a listener did email and asked, how did the phrase holy day become holiday? And it's an interesting question in view of the secularization of the Christmas season. In fact, the word does mean holy day, as it sounds like. And originally in Old English, it was one word. But as the centuries progressed, along about the mid-1400s, there became a differentiation in the spellings. There was holy day, two words, there was holy day hyphenated, and there was holiday. And at the same time, there was a differentiation in the meanings of the words. Holy day maintained its old meaning, which was a consecrated day or a religious festival. But it also, the holiday word, that was one word, acquired a more secular meaning, and it meant, in the words of the OED, a day on which ordinary occupations of an individual or community are suspended, a day of exemption or cessation from work, a day of festivity, recreation, or amusement. And ever since, for the last 600 years, we have maintained a different spelling and the two different forms of the word to represent the secular and the religious aspects of the word holiday, holy day. So that's how it developed those two meanings, and those we still recognize those different senses and different spellings of the word.
I'm not sure of this, but I think that the Jewish way of saying holiday, Yom Tov, really means good day, happy day, or something like that.
Yes.
And it's really in the same spirit, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and that's perhaps why some people are some religious people are critical of the use of holiday as in exchange for Christmas, because we're using it in the same way that we're saying Gesundheit instead of God bless you.
Exactly. But that's the way these things develop. And like it or not, many parts of society are becoming secularized. Some parts are becoming more religious. But these are all natural developments, and it's all one world, and we all have to share it.
Talking about holidays, actually, I forgot to mention earlier when we were talking about Rebecca West that today is her birthday.
Ah.
So later I'm going to go up and raise a glass to the memory of Rebecca West.
Yeah, great old gal.
Should we take some calls?
Yes, please.
Okay, we go to John from Paramus. Hi, you're on the air.
Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and Happy New Year to all.
Okay.
I just would like to know the word nativity, where what that comes from, and is it only used around Christmas time, and what's the origin of nativity?
Well, it's used to mean the nativity with a capital N these days, but it comes from a Latin word for birth, which you'll have to excuse me for not being a Latinist.
Well, yeah, I would assume natal is connected to that word.
Yes, and that's what it comes from. So it wasn't always a religious term, but it has developed that way.
Okay, John.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And Meg from Larchmont. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, happy holidays.
Same to you.
So I'm hoping you can help me with the raging family debate. We came up with what we thought was a brilliant idea for a holiday card, and it says, joy is where we have been, and it lists all the places we've been this year, and love is who we have seen. But, of course, the kind of recurring issue is it who we have seen or whom we have seen?
Well, technically it should be whom, but a lot of grammarians these days are coming to think that at the in a phrase like that, if it's not the object of a preposition, that you can get away with who.
It sounds kind of clumsy in that context.
It would sound a little bit formal, I would think, on a friendly family greeting card. To say
right,
home.
And then there's always the issue that the verb to be feels like an equalizer and not. It doesn't feel like it's taking an object.
Oh, right. Yeah, it does take an object. But actually, come to think of it, is who we have seen. You know, you may be right. It may take the nominative case after all, is who I am. Yes, who we have seen.
Well,
yes,
I
think you could justify who there.
Well, thank you. I take pleasure that it's as tricky for you as it is for me.
Yeah, well, I've always wondered why we didn't call that group the whom. But don't address any of your cards to whom it might concern.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Thank you so much for calling us. We go now to Ellen from Georgetown, Connecticut. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a non-holiday question, if that's okay.
Fine.
That's fine.
I'm hoping you can help me in my quest to end the misuse of the word proverbial.
Mm-hmm.
I think people tend to mean cliche, and actually on the Brian Lehrer show earlier, I heard somebody say the proverbial laser, and I have yet to have encountered a proverb regarding a laser.
The proverbial laser.
Laser.
Yeah, that's
maybe it's a person's name.
Proverbial is often used just to mean something like that laser that we all know about.
I tend to feel people use it in terms of the word cliche instead.
Yeah, or just the familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. If something doesn't have to do with a proverb, it probably doesn't deserve the word proverbial. Similarly, people use legendary a lot about things that really are not legendary. They're not the stuff of legend. So that's overused,
too. Well, legendary is often used to describe somebody who's been in show business for a long time.
Right. But don't you think it's a little tired?
Oh, absolutely.
It's probably it was probably nice the first few times it was used. But
it's been appended to Tony Bennett's name now.
Oh, has it?
Real legends tend to be fictional, too, so
yes.
That doesn't reflect well.
Thank you for calling us. Sherry on the Upper West Side says, can you ask Pat about the words Scrooge and Grinch?
Oh.
Were these words ever used before their famous books?
I I think Dickens made up the word Scrooge. I don't know that for sure. I'm saying it off the top of my head. But I know that he made quite a thing about inventing names. He went through many, many possibilities for Tiny Tim. I can't remember what some of them were, but some of them were kind of funny.
And Grinch sounds to me like Grinch Dr. Seuss like a invention, Seuss. Too.
Yes, and Dr. Seuss was pretty original, too. So I would guess that those were invented at the time rather than taken from somewhere else.
And in both cases, I guess because they described something that needed to have a word of its own.
Right.
And they have come into they're part of our language now.
Yes. But even before we became familiar with them, they had a kind of onomatopoeic resonance. You think that something called a Grinch is going to be a Grinch. And somebody named Scrooge is going to be stingy.
Hmm. I learned about Scrooge first from Donald Duck, of course.
Oh, Scrooge McDuck. Yes. Uncle Scrooge, yes. Uncle Scrooge was cheap.
Jennifer from Glen Rock, New Jersey. Hi, you're on there.
Hi. I love when you are on the show, so thank you. And I love the show. So I have been waiting to ask this question forever, and I'm always reminded of it during the holidays when everybody's cards come. But what is the proper way to pluralize a last name, especially one that ends in the CH combination?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it done, for example, the French family.
Mm-hmm. You add
they
ES.
Had the French, you add ES. That's
ES.
What I was guessing. But I've seen people do, say, the apostrophe S, say the Smith apostrophe
oh.
S.
Yeah.
Incorrect, right?
Yes. Right.
Well, I
you
think the apostrophe is probably the most misused punctuation
right.
mark of all.
Yes, it
yes.
is. And I can say that because I have one in my name. And I can tell you that I can never get businesses to include it in my name. It belongs there. But on the other hand, everyone puts it in where it doesn't belong. But they won't let me have it in my name. So I get a little exercised about that sometimes.
Right.
Does that mean that when you get credit cards and such, that they won't put an apostrophe
right. They'll say,
between
we
the
don't,
O and the C?
Our computer doesn't have a character for that. They don't recognize
yeah.
it. You know, you have to fill out these things with little blocks, and only letters can go in the blocks.
Well, they
that
should
kind of
borrow
thing.
It from the greeting card printer.
Yes.
Plenty
I know.
On there from
I
the
know.
Last name.
I don't see the problem myself.
Jennifer, thank you so much for calling us. And we'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll be taking more of your calls at 212-433-9692. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org.
Wonderful phrase to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And
we're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, whose books include Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, Woe Is I Junior, and Origin of the Specious. And I assume there's another one in the works.
There is.
Okay, well, whenever you're ready, you can tell us about it.
All right.
Meanwhile, you mentioned that you continue to get all sorts of interesting inquiries from our listeners.
I do.
We do make your website, we announce your website on a
mm-hmm.
regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
It's grammophobia.com.
Mm-hmm.
And people write in and ask you language questions. You try to answer them as if you can.
Yes, yes, I do. I answer everybody. If you don't hear from me, it's probably because it got lost or something. Just try again.
Okay. Well, what about the word hobnob? Didn't somebody write in
right.
about that? And I've never thought about hobnob, and yet...
I haven't either. We all know what it means to hang out with, have a good time with, familiarly congregate, that kind of thing. I always thought it had something to do with the hob, which is a hearth, you know, that sort of thing. But wrong.
Is it about the Hobbs and Hobnots?
Exactly. You're exactly right.
I was just making a bad pun.
No, you're exactly right. In Middle English, the word have, and in Old English have, was hab or hebba. And in the 1500s, the figurative meaning of hab-nab or hab or nab was probably related to that Old English verb to have, so that hab-nab meant have not. Now, it's thought that it was used figuratively to mean win or lose, hit or miss, come or go, that sort of thing, and that it was used as a drinking phrase when people clinked glasses or raised a toast to each other in a pub. They'd say, well, hab-nab, or it later became hob-nob, and it would mean have not. And sometimes hobbing and nobbing meant exchanging drinks, like you'd pay for one round, I'd pay for another, that sort of thing. So it became a drinking phrase. And later on, much later on in the 19th century, to hobnob meant to hang out with or party with or become familiar with.
And that's what enriches the language, although when
exactly.
things like that happen now, we get listeners who complain that the language is being debased.
True. Now, if that had never – probably someone in the days of Old English would have thought, well, if habba starts to become a drinking phrase, that's going to be a debasement of the language.
The end of civilization as we
exactly,
know it.
Exactly, exactly.
Let's go to another caller. Pauline, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. In response to the other caller's question about the name Grinch, many years ago when I was in grad school, I was on a listserv and SaxNet for Anglo-Saxon scholars. We know that Dr. Seuss studied Anglo-Saxon at Oxford, and we were speculating on the similarities between the beginning of Beowulf and the beginning of the Grinch.
Ah.
You have a creature who lives outside town in the wilderness by himself, and is enraged by the sound of music coming from the town. And the name Grendel, the monster in Beowulf, and mm-hmm. the word Grinch are kind of similar. So it's a possibility. We
You're
may
right.
never know.
That's very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah,
for
you
that.
Were hobnobbing with your friends when you discussed
yes.
this?
Hobnobbing online with other Anglo-Saxonists. And, you know, I don't know if anybody there was lifting a glass of ale at the time, but...
Well, thank you. Actually, that it sounds quite plausible.
Yes, yes.
We have people writing in with some interesting questions. For example, Ken in Soho wonders how the British came to use the word holiday mm-hmm. for vacation.
Uh-huh.
I'm going on holiday.
Uh-huh. Well, I talked about how holiday came to mean a day of rest. In the British Isles, it means more or less a vacation. We say go on vacation. They say go on holiday. So when we refer
but they
to
would
a
say
holiday,
probably
we usually mean one day.
But they probably also are associating it with the time you take off
oh, sure.
During a holiday.
Right, right. For Americans, a holiday usually means one day, but for the Brits, it may mean a month in Spain or your trip to Paris recently.
Well, they also have Boxing Day and all sorts
oh, of
other
course.
Strange things. Lorraine from Manhattan saw the word disfluency in an academic paper. Is that a real word? Yes.
Well, not that I know of, but who knows?
But that's the
we
sort of
all
thing
know
we see in
it
academic
means.
Papers.
It's a lack of fluency or an unfluent thing, I suppose. But academic writing is sometimes amusing, I think.
Now, Maureen asks about pluralizing a last name like Higgins or mm-hmm. Collins. We mm-hmm. add ES to that as well?
Right. If it ends in S, it works exactly the same way as any other noun would. For instance, the word dress ends in S, you'd add ES to it. If someone's name ends in S, you do the same thing. There's nothing really magical about names.
Another person asks... Clay in Brooklyn, can you confirm that it is a misuse to use jive in place of jibe when mm-hmm. meaning mm-hmm. to be in accord with?
Well, usually jibe means to joke or to jab at someone. And jive means to lie or fool around. That
Although
sort of
there's
thing.
I love coffee, similar. I love tea, I like the Java jive in it, loves me. Now, I always wondered what jive meant in that context.
Yeah, I don't know. To tell you the truth, I did a little paragraph on the difference between jive and jibe in Woe Is I, and I've clean forgotten it.
If anybody out there has a copy of the book, will you look it up for us, please? Let's go to Lee from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, the word zeitgeist. Is that a noun or a verb or both?
It's a noun.
And would you use it in a sentence?
You want me to?
Yes, go ahead.
The reason that Bill Clinton smoked pot, or if he did, was because it was part of the zeitgeist at the college at the time.
Okie doke.
The general, that was probably an unfair, but it's what
no,
occurred to me at the moment.
No, it was the zeitgeist in most colleges, I think.
But zeitgeist means the kind of like the
The ghost of the time, isn't that it? The spirit of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we've seen people blame all sorts of terrible things on the zeitgeist, but we can also say that right now the zeitgeist is political polarization.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Judy from Brooklyn says, upspeak is becoming more common, making statements as they sound like questions. But that's not really a grammatical thing. That's simply...
Right. And it's not actually new. I think it's been observed since the 70s, I think. And it's believed to have started out on the West Coast, I think. I'm not a phonetician.
We call it Valley Girl speak, don't we?
Right, right. And it involves making everything sound like a question, that sort of thing.
We go now to Jim from Freeport, Long Island. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you? Love the show.
And we love you, Jim.
Oh. I was thinking about plurals of names and apostrophes after names and so on. And I believe the caller said something like, we go to the Smiths. Well, the Smiths is a place owned by either a single Smith or a family of Smiths, and I would say Smiths plural plus the apostrophe, but I've heard a lot of debate about that.
Oh,
and, of course,
yeah,
if I was going to visit Robert the Bruce, I might say the Bruces with only the apostrophe S.
Well, there shouldn't be a debate about it. It's not as if it's a matter of opinion. If a family is named Smith, the house is the Smiths' house.
Which is the plural.
And it's spelled plural apostrophe. Smith with an S followed by an apostrophe.
What if Smith is single?
Then it is John Smith's house, S-M-I-T-H apostrophe S.
My whole point was the ambiguity and the fact that it matters which Smith you're talking about. But while I was on hold, I got...
But I want to go a little further with this for just a second, because sure. There are other words that confuse people along these lines. For example, women, which is plural.
Right.
So you would say women's apostrophe S, and
right.
apostrophe S.
Right.
But then you might say the girls' night out, and then put an apostrophe after the S.
Right, because women is one of those plurals that's not formed by adding an S. So it's like men. It's already plural to begin with, so you wouldn't just add an apostrophe because there's a S sound at the end.
Okay, Jim, what's the other thing you wanted to say?
I was just saying plural possessives are always fun. Hobnob. Knob is a word that's often used to mean upper class, rich or royalty or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In San Francisco, they even have Knob Hill. I was curious whether there's any connection there.
Right. I don't think there is a connection. That's a K-N. I think it started out as K-N-O-B. I'm not sure about that. But the knob that's a big wheel is not the same as the knob in hobnob. That originally came to mean was a negative form of the verb have.
Jerry from, where is it? Orphan Hastings? Okay.
Well,
you're on the air.
Question that the burning question of the day is the derivation of the word Grinch. It turns out that it has a direct French root First of all, there's a verb in French, which is spelled G-R-I-N-C-E-R, pronounced grincer, which is the sound produced by scraping some pieces of metal together, like when the train comes into the 14th Street station and the wheels are scraping along the tracks. And that became an adjective, G-R-I-N-C-H-E-U-X, which is grincheux, which is a person who is continually complaining, in other words, a pain in the neck. So if you take G-R-I-N-C-H-E-U-X and drop off the E-U-X, then you've left with Grinch. I'm talking to you.
Yeah, well, isn't that what they're discovering is that Dr. Seuss was probably the most educated man in the world.
But then we knew that already.
He knew Old English. He knew French. Just one more thing maybe we can get more in. But Bill in Queens asks if you can elaborate on how the word Christmas came to replace the word Yule in the 12th century.
Well, I don't actually know why it replaced it, but it became more of a Christian holiday, I suppose, and the word Christ was inserted into it. I'm guessing.
And mass. Maybe
which was
that's when you went
ceremony.
To church on the
right. And the word Christmas represents the original spelling of the or original pronunciation of Christ, which was it started out as Christ, Christos, Christ.
We're going to slip Andy in here. Andy, you have to make it very quick.
Okay, disfluency. I'm thinking of orientate, which I heard one of the guests say yesterday on NPR. Isn't that just adding an unnecessary syllable?
Yes, it is. That's a popular word in Britain, but here we mainly say orient.
But I could see an orient potentate. Is that an abbreviation, do you think?
I think it may be. Uh-huh. Orientate is a potentate in
okay,
Orient.
Well, let's give people the email address again.
Grammarphobia.com, mailbox@grammarphobia.com.
And
I'll be happy to answer.
And, of course, there are all the books, Woe Is I Junior, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and
Origin of the Species.
And Patricia T. O'Connor will be back on our show in case you want to call in the next time she's here on January 18th. And, Pat, it's always a lot of fun to have you here. And as you know, people keep on telling us that this is their favorite segment, and I'm wondering what I'm doing wrong on all the rest of the shows.